So good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's fantastic to be back in Canada. And I'll be talking today about gravitational wave standard sirens, the gravitational wave counterparts of standard candles, and measuring Hubble's constant with SO. And so in the aim of this talk, I hope to sort of outline the status as well as challenges as I foresee them in this exciting new field. And so I'll be discussing work that's been done with large, with large and small collaborations, as well as this list of collaborators, as well as my fantastic group members. Indeed, Banafshe Shiralu is here in the audience, which is very exciting. She's joining next month. And our efforts are really part of a wider and multitude of efforts that are happening in gravitational waves in the Amsterdam landscape, so I really would like to invite you all to come and visit at some point and see what's going on. So in the last few years, the LIGO and Virgo detectors have not only detected gravitational waves, black holes, but we have now observed at least 10 binary black hole mergers. You know, these are the most luminous events that we've seen in the universe, yet we don't understand the diversity that we're seeing in the fundamental parameters, such as the masses of these systems. And over two years ago, for the first time, we observed what we believe to be a neutron star merger in gravitational waves. We dub this GW170817 because of the dates of the detection in gravitational waves. And this was indeed observed in every part of the electromagnetic spectrum as well, which really allowed for the kind of this momentous plethora of discoveries that were associated with this. For the first time, we were able to actually pinpoint where a gravitational wave merger happened, so we knew where its host galaxy was. And this indeed, I'll be discussing this in the context of standard sirens. Also, just to mention, after a year and a half of being offline, the third science run of the LIGO-Virgo detectors began on the 1st of April, 2019. We've now entered this era of open LIGO-Virgo alerts of potential candidates. And so just in the last several months, we have already announced 20 binary black hole and 4 neutron star binary merger candidates. So I should really underline these are candidates. Only one of these neutron stars has really been confirmed by the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, and the paper is underway. And no electromagnetic counterparts have yet been announced in association to these candidates. And so, of course, we are now moving into this era, once again referring to the morning talks, about going into sort of populations of events. And so just to take a step back, of course, the game changer has come for systems where we have at least one system has some matter, so a neutron star black hole. Within the frequency band of these detectors, we're observing really the final minute in the lifetime of these systems. And what we expected and what we have now observed is that during the complicated merger, there should be some delayed matter outflows, which are responsible for the electromagnetic counterparts that we're seeing at different timescales and frequencies. Okay? And the excitement has been that from gravitational waves, as I'll discuss, we can actually infer fundamental parameters about the progenitor as well as the remnants. And from the electromagnetic side, we're learning not only about the host galaxy, but as well about the energetics. So really, to put these in their full sort of physics and cosmological context, we need to have both probes. And so GW170817, you know, resulted not just in one discovery, but multiple discoveries. Because of the time constraints, I'm only going to be discussing this first gravitational wave standard siren, Hubble constant constraint, where the basic principle was first proposed by Bernard Schütz in 86, that from gravitational waves, we would have an absolutely calibrated distance measure. And from an electromagnetic counterpart, we could get the redshift, or indeed in his original paper, he stated that we could actually associate H-naught measurement with every galaxy that is within some gravitational wave localization volume. And we call this method a sort of statistical standard siren approach. I should really mention, I can't see him, but Neil is here. Neil actually first proposed the idea of using neutron star binaries and short gamma ray bursts in the context of Hubble constant constraint measurements. So really, I want to say a big thank you and shout out to Neil, because I remember having those first discussions as a PhD student when I visited. So thank you. So I'm going to talk at the beginning how to infer the luminosity distance, really the physics behind gravitational wave measurements. The second part, I'm only very briefly going to discuss the electromagnetic follow-up, really in the context of whether, you know, how challenging it is to actually identify these EM counterparts for these events. Part three, really, to discuss how we can actually measure H naught using these joint observations, and end with my own views and perspectives. I should mention there are really now thousands of papers on this one event, so the references will be a bare minimum. So without further ado, on August the 17th, 2017, I'm showing here the time frequency stamp of the first gravitational wave signal from this binary neutron star merger. It was the loudest. It had a signal to noise ratio of 32, the longest, 100 seconds, a false alarm rate in 1 in 80,000 years. And what I really want to emphasize is this characteristic chirp, this ever-increasing frequency and amplitude, really to illustrate how we can actually infer information already from these simple power spectrograms of the signal. And I should stress that 1.7 seconds later, the Fermi and Integral satellites already detected a burst of gamma ray bursts. Okay, so our measurable in gravitational wave physics is this dimensionless gravitational wave strain. And importantly and critical for standard science, it has this 1 over distance to the source dependence. It has two polarizations, H plus and H cross. They act as transverse tidal tails. And so essentially, these interferometers are measuring a linear combination of these two polarizations, weighted by some antenna functions, so some quadrupolar antenna functions. And we now have this current operational network of the two LIGO detectors, the Virgo detector, which I'm associated with in Pisa, and coming online this year, the Kagra, the Japanese detector in the Kamioka mines, and they're operating within this frequency band of 24 to a few kilohertz, most numerous sources that we're seeing are these in-spiraling emerging binaries. And we can understand this frequency chirp simply by equating the loss of orbital energy with the Newtonian quadrupole formula of gravitational radiation using the energy balance equation. And within a few steps, we can get an expression for the frequency chirp, this F dot, which is a function of the frequency and this calligraphic M, the so-called chirp mass, which is simply a combination of the two masses. Okay, so by measuring F and F dot, as well as F max, we immediately knew from this power spectrogram that we were looking at a system that had a chirp mass of about 1.18 solar masses, and F max indicated that the orbital separation was tens of kilometers, so ruling out the potential that these objects could be actually white dwarfs, for instance, and indicating that the masses were neutron stars. Now, to actually infer information, and for much weaker signals, we need to have a very accurate model of what this waveform looks like. We call this waveform. It comprises these three phases, the in-spiral, the merge, or the post-merge, and ring down if it's a binary black hole. And if you recall, the expression for the frequency chirp within the frequency band operating, the LIGO-Virgo instruments for tens of solar mass binary black holes are most sensitive to this strong field regime of the merger, where we really rely on numerical relativity. In the case of neutron star black hole mergers, which have a few solar masses, we are observing thousands of cycles of the in-spiral. Okay, so this is where we can model this extremely accurately using post-Newtonian methods in general relativity, where 1pn is v squared over c squared, where v is the characteristic orbital velocity. And as I mentioned, at Newtonian order, this is driven by the chirp mass. At higher post-Newtonian order in the gravitational wave, for instance, other parameters such as the reduced mass, the spin orbit, spin-spin coupling appear as a 2pn, and tidal deformability can cause significant modulation of the waveform. And this impacts how well we can actually measure things like the individual masses, the spins, et cetera, of the systems that you've probably seen various plots of. But in order to actually infer the information sort of on one slide, I'm just outlining how we can actually just cross-correlate the detector output with these template banks of models, typically 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 waveforms. I should stress that decades of analytical and numerical work have gone into actually creating these in-spiral merger and post-merger waveforms. And then actually not only detect, but then actually explicitly map out the posterior probability density functions of the vector set of parameters that our waveform depends on using random stochastic techniques, MCMC and nested sampling methods, and extracting a whole host of information that I'm listing here, really sort of critical from what we can pull out of the gravitational wave signal, the redshifted masses. So I should just stress here that the chirp mass here has the units of time. So essentially, we're always measuring redshifted masses from our gravitational wave strain. I'm not sure why there's a shadow. The spins, okay, sorry. and then the geometric properties such as the inclination angle and the luminosity distance, which appear in the amplitude of each polarization. It has a different dependence on the inclination angle, and the source position, which appears in the antenna functions. And indeed, for these geometric properties, there's a large degeneracy that we see between these parameters. For these parameters, these appear in the gravitational wave phase. So typically for the low mass systems that we're talking about, we're tracking thousands of cycles. And just to illustrate sort of the critical degeneracy for standard sirens, I'm showing a plot from a paper done with Neil actually almost 10 years ago, showing the gravitational wave distance and inclination degeneracy for a simulated binary, a binary neutron star that I ran. The shown in gray are the 1D PDFs for the distance and the cosine inclination. In blue, the 2D PDFs in cosine inclination and distance. For this simulated binary with the same orientation, the same sky position, everything was the same except that I just varied the distance. And you can essentially see, as you go to lower signal to noise ratio, you can see really this degeneracy and further out distances, this blue banana sort of blows up. Yes, and it already sort of happens at relatively high signal to noise ratios. Okay, and so this is really critical, and I'll return this to this later. In terms of the sky localization, these antenna functions have very broad antenna patterns. You need to have at least 2, preferably 3, to do triangulation of the arrival signals of the detector. So shown here is the 30 square degrees that we were able to localize because we had 3 detectors operating. Virgo just happened to come online 17 days before the event. And we were able to send out distance alerts, something that I had worked on, to 40 megaparsecs plus or minus 10 within about 5 hours of the event, the first sky maps as well as distance. And this was critical because it allowed us to actually cross-correlate the gravitational wave localization volumes with galaxy catalogs. Many groups, including the Swift telescope, actually went ahead and built ranked lists of galaxy catalogs depending on stellar mass or B-band luminosity. And as night fell, basically in Chile, the first optical transient was observed or was discovered by the Swope telescope in Las Campanas. So you can see the bright, the sort of pinpoint of the transient compared to archival images in the elliptical galaxy NGC 4993 at 40 megaparsecs. I should stress that subsequent monitoring of this event, spectroscopic, as well as information from the light curve evolution, were really key to showing that it was a transient unlike any we had seen and that this was actually the real deal. Okay, and so this is not the case that we're seeing for the weaker signals that are being sent out at the moment, where we're really having to deal with this needle in the haystack issue of astrophysical transients. This was really a very beautiful, but very straightforward event, just because it was so bright, so close, and so easy to see. So that's sort of critical. The second thing I will briefly, and this is really going to be a speed through of what happened in the multi-messenger observations, but thanks to the gravitational waves, the gamma rays, as well as this optical transient, this really initiated this unprecedented follow-up campaign, I think, for any other astronomical effort, 100 instruments, 70 teams. This is encapsulated sort of in this compendium paper that I was coordinating with over 3,500 co-authors, so really a third of the astronomy community was involved in the world. And shown here is the different wave bands as a function of time since merger. And the horizontal lines show when the detections were made. So the optical 11, 12 hours later, Gemini, 15 hours with the Swift telescope, 9 days, the X-ray popped up in Chandra, and 16 days, the VLA observed the radio counterpart. So it was just truly magnificent. What made it so magnificent was not just that we had this crazy amount of data, but that it really also agreed with this picture that during the merger, there should be two types of matter outflows resulting in this plethora of electromagnetic counterparts. So broadly speaking, the picture was that during this merger, there should be tidal tails or disk winds from some short-lived accretion disk resulting in this so-called kilonova, this UVOIR transient, this R-process transient, which is powered by rapid neutron capture nucleosynthesis. Okay, so the idea being that there's this initially very neutron-rich material, this it adiabatically evolves, the free neutrons result in R-process nucleosynthesis occurring, you build up all these heavy unstable elements, and then these beta decay and fission back to stability, so you have this thermal source of heating. Okay, so this was indeed what we observed with the UVOIR observations. And in the case of the short gamma ray burst, the other matter outflow that was expected and what has now been confirmed is that there was an ultra-relativistic jet. So you have some centrifugally supported accretion disk, which is powering this relativistic jet. And as the jet decelerates, you see this afterglow emission as it hits the interstellar medium, you see this afterglow emission on the sort of days to months timescale, which indeed was observed. So the principle being that the material is eventually heated by either radioactivity or shocks. So these are the two electromagnetic counterparts that were observed in this case. The challenges are that the electromagnetic signatures depend on the geometry, the source and remnant properties, as well as the time scales, depending on the physical processes. And I'm going to focus on just one result that I think was very important in the context of standard sirens. So essentially, I have not mentioned that this GRB was quite puzzling at the time. It was our closest short gamma ray burst that we'd seen by a factor of 10, but our least bright, I mean, it was our least bright by I think a factor of 1,000 or so. And so it really took continuous monitoring in the X-rays and radio for the subsequent year to really answer this question of whether this was actually a normal short gamma ray burst. And this was done with beautiful observations with the VLBI, where essentially using two epochs of measurements, we were able to say something about constrain the proper motion of the source to 2.7 milliarcseconds. And the jet, we had a superluminal jet of V over C apparent of 4.7, pointing to the fact that this jet had some kind of structure to it. Importantly, with a half opening angle of plus or minus 15 degrees, it seemed to be piercing through some material that may have formed a cocoon around it. But really critically, and what I want to stress, is that we were able for the first time to actually observe the inclination angle to the binary, which was 20 plus or minus 5 degrees. Okay, so you can think, okay, why was this important? I should stress also that it was in a very low circumburst density. Okay, so coming now to the actual measurements. This was the state of the field. With this event, you know, now we are looking at having joint data sets coming from the electromagnetic and the gravitational wave side. I've shown this plot. The question is how to deal with the different degeneracies. The modeling uncertainties, really the systematic modeling uncertainties, are enormous on the electromagnetic side. And to actually use and to systematically combine these to do strong binary characterization, and of course to look at populations as we're doing now. And I think the standard SIREN measurement really does sort of exemplify the beauty of doing this joint combination. So what I'm showing here is the 1D PDF of the H0 measurement shown in blue for this event. The 1 sigma error bars are given here. This was obtained assuming that we knew the source position. Okay, and in orange and green, these were the then, at the time, 2 years ago, the error bars from the Shoes and Planck collaboration. We'll obviously be having talks about this this afternoon. And in this, for this, you know, very low redshift source, the measured Hubble flow velocity was given as such, and we estimated a peculiar velocity error of 150 kilometers per second. Okay, but the main limiting degeneracy, and of course this was very exciting, I should stress, because it was really our first empirical measurement using gravitational waves to have this sort of independent to the cosmological distance ladder measurement, but of course hugely and sort of very, very broad for this one event. the main challenge was this inclination angle and distance degeneracy that I mentioned. So shown here is the cosine inclination as a function of H naught, the 1 sigma, 2 sigma plots for this event. Okay, and I'd like to stress that even though it was such a large signal to noise ratio, you know, in some sense it was unfavorable because Virgo barely detected this event. It had a signal to noise ratio of 3. So we were really not sensitive to the polarization of both polarizations, the H plus and H cross for this event. The other thing I should stress is that if you assume a certain cosmology, we were able to actually then, from the gravitational wave side, infer something about the inclination angle to the binary. Okay, so from just without assuming a cosmology, it was 56 degrees or less from the orbital angular momentum axis. And if you assume it, we knew it was less than 28 degrees. But I mentioned that we had this VLBI measurement that came a year later. And indeed, what I'm showing here now is how this inclination angle measurement from the radio actually helped improve the distance measure. So shown here is the distance as a function of the inclination angle. This was the original LIGO-Virgo posterior that I showed previously. And shown in blue here is the constrained measurement with the VLBI and light curve measurements. Okay, so this actually enabled for the single event, the Hubble measurement, to actually improve by a factor of 2 to 3. Okay, so really stressing how incredible it is to actually have joint measurements. I should also stress that in this case, when the radio was added, you know, really the systematic error coming from the peculiar velocity became important, and there is new work that's coming online this week on the archive that's actually looking to actually how to improve this estimate. So in the last 5-10 minutes, I just want to end with the perspectives. And so, of course, I've discussed just this one event. We've discussed a lot today about using populations. And indeed, in this case, the question of how populations of gravitational wave and electromagnetic counterparts could actually potentially resolve the Hubble trouble. And so what I'm going to show here is a paper, or the results of a paper led by Stephen Feeney and others. And these are simulations run by my then postdoc, Andrew Williamson, for 50 binary neutron stars. Okay, the 1D PDFs are shown in the left panel, the joint PDF will be shown in the middle panel, and the signal-to-noise ratio of each binary will be shown here. And through these simulations, so using staggered instrument sensitivity curves, we were able to show that about 50 binaries, maybe extrapolating, or this is really a very rough number, 8 years, would allow us to actually reach a precision of about 1.8%. Really, you're just using a 1/√n argument. Here you can see that the high signal-to-noise ratios really dominate the joint PDF. And of course, this work is actually quite highly optimistic because it assumes that we have an electromagnetic counterpart for every one of these binary neutron star mergers. Okay? But just to give you a flavor of the importance of looking at populations, and of course, this is when we get into this issue of really making sure we have unbiased as well as precise estimators. I should just mention that if you use this 1/√m for the VLBI plus GW measurement, you only need about 15 binaries. But of course, there are many, many caveats to that, in the sense that, you know, it needs to be relatively close in order to actually do this very ambitious VLBI measurement. The second thing that we're really, really excited about is the potential to observe an electromagnetic counterpart from a neutron star black hole merger. You may have heard that on August the 14th, in the middle of the European summer, there was this candidate that was announced that could be a neutron star black hole, or indeed a low mass black hole merger. A lot of telescope has actually gone to observing this. For standard Siren measurements, it's incredibly exciting because for these systems, we expect that the black hole actually may have significant spin, may be significantly misaligned compared to neutron stars, which we assume to actually have very low dimensional spins from binary pulsar measurements, and that indeed there will be much more matter outflow. And so this sort of spin precession can actually improve. If you remember the beating of the waveform that I showed, the distance measures by a factor of 2 to 10 that was shown in a paper by Vitaly et al. So I'll just give an example, if I can do this, of this nice video that shows an example of this asymmetry sort of matter outflow that I mentioned for a neutron star black hole with a mass ratio of 3, the black hole has a dimensional spin of 0.5 and is misaligned by, I think, about 80 degrees. But just to give you an idea that in some sense, the matter outflow can be as much as 0.1 to 0.15 solar masses. So it may indeed be much brighter. Okay. The third point is that without a counterpart, we can examine the case GW170817 and ask the question, okay, if we didn't see a counterpart, how well could we have measured H0 using the statistical measure method, which I mentioned, where you associate H0 with every host galaxy in the gravitational wave volume. So in this case, the volume was 290 megaparsecs. There were about 400 galaxies. And what I'm showing in green here is this 1D, is this PDF of H-naught. These are the one sigma error bars, okay, compared to the pink line, which assumes that you do have the EM counterparts. So the Hubble measurements in this case are several factors worse than in the case of actually having an EM counterpart. There are many subtleties in involving, for instance, completeness as well as galaxy weighting if you want to do something in terms of stellar mass or B-band luminosity. And of course, as I mentioned in the morning, I mean at the beginning, basically we are now in this exciting era where we're essentially having this kind of popcorn of binary black hole events happening once or twice a week. They really are becoming sort of the vanilla events that we're seeing. And so you can also ask this question, returning to the original Schütz idea, how well can we actually measure H-naught without having an electromagnetic counterpart exploiting the binary black hole number. And there was a very nice paper that came out from the DES plus LIGO-Virgo collaboration that did this for the first binary black hole merger that was seen with Virgo August the 14th in 2017. Okay, it was the most well-localized BBH merger that we saw in the first two science runs, 60 square degrees at about 500 megaparsecs. In this case, the gravitational wave volume was about 500 times worse than the one for GW170817. So there were actually 77,000 galaxies, okay? And hence shown in red here is the H-naught measurement for this one event, okay? So extremely broad, you can see the priors, the uniform priors that you're assuming really do impact the measurement. But I think it's very exciting and a proof of principle of actually using the method. And indeed, in the case of populations of binary black holes, this forecasting paper shows the measurement accuracy of H-naught as a function of the time scale that you can expect to actually have these measures. And in red and in orange show how well we can actually expect to measure H-naught with binary black holes, so about 10% by 2026. And you can compare this to the green line where in these simulations, the binary neutron star is assumed to have an electromagnetic counterpart. So here, actually, they estimate that you can have a precision of about 2% by 2022 and maybe 1% by 2026. But just to really stress that, I think the order of magnitude number you should bear in mind for binary black holes is this sort of several hundred events to get 5%. Okay, so just finishing, I'd like to just outline the final challenges. This was a very, very easy event in terms of follow-up, in terms of actually finding the electromagnetic counterparts for future events. We must expect a diversity. Some may come with a kilonova, some may come with a GRB. It really depends on the binary mass, the remnant, etc., in terms of the matter outflows or the nature. Second is that we should really build, and we are in the construct of actually building this coherent model to actually do this joint characterization of these multiple data sets for the in-spiral merger and post-merger. Okay, and the complexity is, of course, the huge variation in distance and time scales. The third is just to really stress that we are moving into this population era. So shown here are the different detectors as a function of timeline. And these are the sort of sky averaged orientation average distances for binary neutron stars. We are currently here. These are the expected numbers from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, where a quarter should be localized to about 20 square degrees, the mean being a couple of binary neutron star mergers. In this science run that will last a year, we're having a break in October for a month. I'm very thankful for that. And then, of course, we have the detectors being upgraded to their true sensitivity, as well as LIGO India coming online by 2025, where, thanks to having more detectors, we can actually localize these. Three quarters should be localized to 20 square degrees. Tens of events should be seen. Binary neutron star mergers should be seen. I haven't shown the numbers for neutron star black holes, as we don't have those constrained rates. But these are the sort of numbers in the next 5 years that you should be thinking of, and that could potentially be detectable. Just to mention this first neutron star binary that's been confirmed in GWs, but no EM counterpart, that happened on the 25th of April this year. I'm showing the sky map for this event, really just to stress how difficult it is to see, to actually identify the EM counterpart, but that indeed heroic efforts are really being undertaken to do so. For this event, it was only seen by one detector, so a quarter of the sky was localized. Okay, so 340 times more in sky error than GW170817. The distance was four times greater than GW170817. But indeed, new facilities such as the Zwicky Transient Facility on Palomar actually scanned this volume in 3 hours. I was completely amazed when I saw this. Hundreds of GCNs came out, about 100 or, you know, even more about this event. There were about 10 to the 5 false positives seen, including interesting candidates that ended up being supernova, M-dwarfs, and AGN. So it's really this sort of big data astronomy needle in the haystack issue that we're looking for a lot of these kind of sub or these harder, less well-localized events. Just to finish, in the mid-2020s, there we already expect a factor of 2 improvement compared to the design sensitivity of advanced LIGO with the funded A-LIGO Plus. So that's a factor of 8 in volume or in rates. And there are many projects, there are 2 projects in Europe, the Einstein Telescope as well as Cosmic Explorer, which aim to have a factor of 10 sensitivity as well as 1,000 in terms of volume and rate, that aim to be built sort of in the late 2030s. Okay, so just to give you an idea, and I really find this completely mind-blowing and actually quite worrying, but also exciting. Shown here is the distance reach. So as a function of redshift for the total source frame mass that we should be able to see with Cosmic Explorer, shown in purple, and Einstein Telescope, the European-led one, in green. And marked here, I've put GW170817, it comes all the way down to the bottom of the, off the plot. So about 10 to the 5 BBH mergers per year, and about 10 to the 4 binary neutron star mergers per year. Okay, so this, I think, is kind of, you know, exceptional. Please do get in touch with me. I'm the co-chair of this group. with regards to these third generation gravitational wave detectors. And indeed, this will be happening at the same time. So this is the previous plot I showed for Einstein Telescope as for LISA going online in 2030, which will be flown in 2034. So you can see the extended axis in terms of total mass. Once again, really just stressing the cosmic reach and the complementarity, and also the challenges that we face in terms of actually potentially observing all the binary black hole mergers that there are in the universe. Okay, so without further ado, 2030s, it's not just going to be pointing your telescope and following up the single sources. Of course, this will be done for loud events, but really moving into this era of large-scale structure and extragalactic astronomy. And of course, I've just spoken about this high-frequency end of the gravitational wave spectrum that spans decades of frequency space. There are many other sources where we expect there to be electromagnetic counterparts, as of course the exotic and the unexpected to come by. So I'll finish there.
much for this amazing talk. Any other questions?
Yeah, thanks. The talk was great, and I think the prospects look really exciting for measuring the Hubble constant. I had one question about the use of the viewing angle information. So you have this beautiful distance indicator from simple GR, and then when you try to estimate the viewing angle, it becomes sort of complex with astrophysics modeling. And looking back at the papers on this, people have done this in somewhat different ways, and I see differences at sort of the level of 4 or 5 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is about the uncertainty that you sort of get by the improved information. So the question I have is this worth it, this trying to estimate the viewing angle and adding in this, you know, what may be this complexity and model errors, or should we just sort of be accepting the larger uncertainty but the cleaner measurement?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. I should say, of course, just from the gravitational waves, we have this very clean measurement. I should mention when my VLBI colleagues contacted me first to say, oh, we actually think we may have this, you know, measurement of the inclination angle and understanding of the structured jet, I was like, oh, it's a lot of messy astrophysics. You know, we really don't want to go down this path.
And there was
of trying to
by Wee Dorsey.
Yes.
That also had viewing angle information. That was different.
Yeah, so that was sort of assuming that it was an off-axis, just standard classical short gamma ray burst. In this case, what the VLBI measurements did show is that this jet did have some structure to it, and indeed, you know, perhaps came from the fact that it had to pierce through this surrounding material. So, you know, I do agree with you that the modeling uncertainties, and I think I stressed this in one of my slides about the challenges on the numerical side, is actually being able to model the actual post-merger, model astrophysical jets, as well as the kilonova emission is really critical in order to do this kind of measurement. In the Hotakazaka work that I was involved with, actually the surprising thing was when we looked at the systematics using and doing the actual MCMC using a sort of Gaussian or top hat model, et cetera, the systematic errors that were coming from the modeling were not the sort of overriding errors that were coming. They were really coming actually from the peculiar velocity estimates. So we were quite surprised in that sense. But yeah, I can show you some plots offline after the talk, just to show you what we did in order to try and explore it. But I should stress that, you know, in terms of hydrodynamical simulations, you know, only a few parts of the phase space have really been explored, but there are just so many groups now and so many, I would say, you know, jet physics with also these, you know, GPU simulations that are coming out, you know, where I do feel sort of optimistic in the next 5 years that we are making a lot of progress.
Will you trust the result that comes out using the astrophysical modeling of the jets versus just the straight up GR?
So I trust more myself, the GR, the clean measurement, but of course I do think, you know, this is a really interesting angle to pursue, because I do see so much advancement happening there as we really start to understand, you know, the jet physics, for instance, at least for this event, but I hope with future events.
So if you don't have the VLBI measurements, maybe I missed this, and if you said it, what does break the degeneracy? Because I think the only equation I saw that looked like it was completely degenerate, so there must be more information you're extracting to break those degenerates.
Between the inclination angle.
The inclination angle and the distance, that's right.
So indeed, you know, this is really sort of just using the Hubble flow, local Hubble flow, and the distance measure from gravitational waves. So this is just, you know, the inherent degeneracy that we're getting. In terms of...
But it's not completely degenerate. Something's...
It's a polarization.
Yeah, it's the polarization. So I should just mention, sorry, there isn't any chalk here, but you know, you're essentially measuring this H plus, F plus plus. Okay, so these are the two polarizations, and they, in terms of the amplitude, have a 1 plus cosine squared inclination.
Okay, that's
EL.
Showed.
And this is, I think, -2 cosine inclination.
I see.
Okay, and the simple, and because the, you know, this event was seen very strongly in the LIGO, Hanford and Livingston detectors, but with Virgo, which had it, this, so these have very similar orientations. They were built that way so that you could have more sensitivity. But with Virgo, because it was a very poor signal, it was in some case, you know, it only had an SNR of 3. It was, you know, the only reason the localization helped was, yeah, so we didn't have that, yes, so that came.
Is there a consensus on what's the endpoint of the first digital measure that
we've seen? So, yeah, it's sort of hotly debated, I think. We believe that it formed a black hole eventually, but there may have been a sort of short-lived hypermassive neutron star there, and this is mainly derived from what was obtained from the kilonova observations that suggest this in terms of what was seen in the optical and infrared. But we don't know, and I should just mention this is because, and we will know this question with more with future interferometers. Okay, it's because the merge actually happened sort of out of band of the gravitational wave. So we're really unable to actually have, apart from having limits, and there are several papers from the LIGO, Virgo, and other groups actually putting limits on what was the energy emitted and what was the remnant, but it really comes more from the electromagnetic aspect in terms of the kilonova emission, because that impacts how blue or red, or basically how neutron-rich the material is, which then impacts what we're observing in the optical and infrared.
Okay, so that's, thank you.